talked about the broadest overview of eating disorders, definitions and how eating disorders develop, and then just some basic fundamentals and how you deal with an eating disorder. A lot of what we talked about yesterday, however, was so general that it may or may not have applied to the woman in your family with an eating disorder. And we asked a question, how can you find out what applies or what fits in her life? And the answer was, ask her. See, part of what we all get caught in is the taboo of bringing up the subject of the eating disorder. I'm working in continuing care with a resident who was here before Christmas, and her family has fallen back into that pattern of noticing some kind of symptom occurrence, but not mentioning it. And I'll say it one more time. If you need to find out what's going on in her life with her symptoms, how can you find out?
Ask her.
Don't ask her therapist. Ask her. And I don't think I can stress that enough. Now, we're going to go ahead and elaborate a little bit more today about eating disorders. The talk today is called What Really is an Eating Disorder? Because it's more than just definitions and symptoms and side effects and outcomes and percentages. What really is an eating disorder? And I'm going to give you four or five different ways to look at that today. And some of them, or all of them, or a mix of them, may fit for the person in your family. So again, the way you're going to find out is by asking her. Okay. So what we're going to talk about is what really is an eating disorder. Let's see if I can. How's that? Does that work? Okay. First thing that we'll talk about briefly, and I will pose it as a question first, is an eating disorder a disease? Now, the reason I ask it as a question is when I was in graduate school in psychology, we learned that mental illnesses in general, and eating disorders in particular, are not diseases. That was stressed real strongly. And the reason was, when you have a disease, what do you have to do to get fixed? Take medicine. Go find an expert who's got the answers and can tell you how to fix it. And he gives you something from outside that you internalize, and then it takes away the problem. And there's a real deficit in that way of understanding eating disorders. If something's going to be done about your eating disorder, who's going to do it? You are. That's exactly right. In our group, we ask the question, if the eating disorder is a bonfire, out of control, who struck the match? Who must take primary responsibility for getting this forest fire under control? It's got to be the eating disordered individual, doesn't it? If dad has got to stop ignoring me in order for me to get well, then who's in charge of my recovery? Dad. And I mean, us dads are pretty cool, but I wouldn't want to make my life dependent on some other person in that way. If I've got to have a boyfriend so that I'm not lonely, so I can stop stuffing my feelings with food, then who's got to change in order for me to get well? All the potential boyfriends in the world. They've got to come when I need them. And men aren't that predictable, are they? And so the responsibility has got to come home. It's got to be me. Now, real frankly, that is a little bit of a misinterpretation of the disease model. And I'm going to tell you now that I strongly believe that, yes, it is accurate to describe an eating disorder as a disease. A disease is defined in one way as a definable set of symptoms that have a natural progression if left untreated and have an outcome that is definable if left untreated. Now, does an eating disorder fit those guidelines? Sure. There are a set of symptoms that we can describe that say, yes, this is an eating disorder. And if you don't treat it, this is what will happen. And it will turn out like this, unless something intervenes. So yeah, I think it is definable as a disease. And secondly, let's go back to just a medical illness for just a minute. Let's say you have pneumonia, and you need to take an antibiotic, and you need to stay out of the rain, and you need to take vitamin C. Who is responsible for your recovery? You still are, aren't you? You still have to follow the recommended guidelines for recovery. So the responsibility for recovery from any disease ultimately falls on me as the individual affected by the disease. So, yeah, I think it's okay to talk about it as a disease. Now, the second thing I want to ask you is an eating disorder a habit? What do you think? Ladies, why don't you help us with the answer? Have there ever been times in your eating disorder when you engaged in the symptom cycle just because? There was no definable trigger event, didn't have any major trauma. It's just, that's what I do when I wake up. Yeah, of course it's a habit. It's a habit like many of our behavioral patterns in life. It does not necessarily have a trigger always associated with that behavioral response. However, is it only a habit? If it were only a habit, all you'd need to do is learn a new habit. I can teach you a new set of habits, a new set of behaviors in 14 to 21 days, basically. And I could send you home, if that's all there is to it. What would happen?
Go back into your old habit.
Automatically. 98% of the individuals treated like that relapse back into the full-blown cycle. Because changing the set of behaviors alone does not address the purpose or intent of those behaviors. You see, animals function almost exclusively on habits or instincts. Humans nearly always have a reason for their behaviors. Even if those behaviors have taken on a life of their own, have become a habit, there's still an underlying purpose or intent or motivation. That's got to be addressed also. So, yes, there is a degree of habit, but not just a habit. I know you've had somebody in your family say, "Why don't you just stop?" It's like, yeah, right. By the way, next time they ask that, why don't you ask them about their smoking? Why don't you just stop? See how they respond, huh? Okay. Next one. Is an eating disorder an addiction?
Yes,
I think it is. And I'm going to give you two or three different ways of looking at this. The first one is, let's compare it to the physiological addictions. There are two symptoms that your body has to show in order to define an event as a physiological addiction. What are they? Do you know?
Withdrawal
is the first one, and the second one is tolerance. Okay, withdrawal. Withdrawal means that when you don't get the substance that you're addicted to, your body starts responding with symptoms of craving. Headaches, tremors, irritability, begin to have dreams. I remember an alcoholic vividly describing to me that cold can of beer with the condensation on it that he could just almost taste. And that was all a dream. I've heard Sheila talking about having food dreams, binging dreams. Have you woken up in such a condition that you could swear you'd binged and you were asleep? See, that's a withdrawal symptom. What happens when you don't get your coffee? You get the shakes, or headaches, or irritability, or you just seem kind of on edge all day long, or like the sharpness of your day has just kind of melted away. That's a withdrawal symptom. Okay? Withdrawal is the first symptom of a physiological addiction. Second one is tolerance. That means it takes more and more of the same substance to get the same effect. Now, I'm going to state our opinion here as a treatment facility and how we guide our treatment program. Our opinion is that neither sugar nor white flour or flour-based products are addictive physiologically. Now, how many of you would swear that chocolate is addictive? There's more anecdotal evidence to support that chocolate is addictive than, I guess, any other food substance. But when we do controlled research, we have a very difficult time supporting any findings that any food substance is addictive. Now, it might be, and we just haven't got good enough research yet for it. I don't know. In your long-range recovery food plan, you may decide to restrict your sugar intake to a minimal amount. When we put you in a regular refeeding program here, we have occasional desserts because we don't believe that sugar is poison, but you're on a fairly low-sugar meal plan here. And that's probably most supportive for long-term recovery. But it's important for me to emphasize that that no foods, as far as we can tell, are addictive. So what is it about an eating disorder that is, that does show withdrawal and tolerance? I think it's the eating disorder cycle. It's the cycle of the eating disorder that is absolutely addictive. Family members, have you ever tried to interfere in one of her binges? What have you gotten? No way. Rage? Would you call that a withdrawal symptom? Ladies, how many times have you deliberately put your phone on the answering machine and not taken your calls because you didn't want it to interrupt your binge? Yeah. When have you absolutely blown him off, got him angry at you so he'd go on to bed so you could do your thing? See, those are withdrawal symptoms. Tolerance. If the frequency of your starving, the frequency of your binging has to increase, doesn't it, to get the same effect. I used to only binge once a week. Now it's three times a day. I used to be able to get the same power rush from starving for 2 days. Now it takes 5 days. It's tolerance. It takes more of the experience to get the same effect. So yeah, I think it's an addiction. Now let me give you another way of looking at addictions. Stanton Peale is a researcher and clinician who's done a lot of work in addictions, and he defines addictions like this. The first criterion is this. An addiction interferes with the other interests in your life. You may have seen the Michael Keaton movie, Clean and Sober, about cocaine addiction. And you'll remember that he's a very successful stockbroker whose career goes down the tubes because of white powder. That he would sacrifice his career, his family, just for his addiction. Have you been there with your eating disorder? How much has it cost you? $200, $300, $400, $500 a month? Maybe? Much less the cost of treatment. How much has it cost you in terms of relationships? Or in terms of social activities? Or commitments and responsibilities that you have totally ignored? See, it interferes with the other interests and activities and responsibilities in your life. And so, the person then turns increasingly toward the only source of gratification in their life, which is their addiction. The very thing that caused the disintegration of my life is now the only thing I get any pleasure out of. And so I turn more and more toward that one source of gratification. The second thing that Stanton Peale talks about is addiction, and addiction is pleasurable only in the absence of pain. In fact, I'm going to go back and put pleasurable in quotes. An addiction is pleasurable only in that it makes the pain go away. Now let's examine that for just a second and make sure you believe it. They tell me that the cocaine rush is one of the most powerful human experiences. That it is so intense and so full of ecstasy that it's easy to become addicted to. Does that sound like it's pleasurable? Sure. They also tell me that the intensity of the cocaine rush lasts 8 seconds. Tell me that there's anything pleasurable about knowing that something's got you through the nose, that you will follow it anywhere it tells you to go, that you'll do whatever it takes to make sure you get your next fix. Tell me that's a pleasurable life. See, the only thing about the addictive cycle is that it numbs me out. It makes the pain go away. It is an anesthesia more effective than anything. Does that fit for eating disorders? How long does the pleasure of a binge last? Not even through the entire binge, does it? Maybe halfway through it, maybe two-thirds of the way through it, you know where it's going, and you're already hating yourself for what's going to follow. That the power rush of starving yourself, how long does that last? Tell me when you start burning your bridges behind you, when your relationships start disintegrating, when you know that your body cannot do what it's supposed to do. Tell me there's pleasure in that. There is not any pleasure in that. It's only that it makes the pain go away that addictions are pleasurable. Third one. An addiction lowers self-esteem. Now, this is a kind of a paradoxical one because many addicts seem very narcissistic, extremely grandiose, charming. I can take on the world. Nothing gets to me. I'm cool, competent, inside and out, suave and sophisticated. But what I'm saying is that that is all a blind, a facade. How can you feel good about yourself knowing that you're not in charge of your life? That some substance or event or experience or person, that something out there is in charge of your life. So we assume when people come in here that their self-esteem has taken an incredible beating, that they do not have a positive sense of self-worth. And so we will begin to help them, number one, admit that, and number two, rebuild a positive sense of self-worth. And then finally, an addiction is pleasurable. I didn't mean pleasurable, excuse me. An addiction is predictable. With all addictions, you know how much it's going to take to get what kind of effect and how long that's going to last and where you're going to have to go to get your next one. See, an addiction gives a rhythm to life. Now, some people's lives are so chaotic, so scrambled, so frantic that they would rather have the routine of an addiction than nothing at all. At least I know what I'm supposed to do when I'm an addict. If all the rest of my life is absolutely crazy and chaotic, then this is a way to build some structure into my life. Again, does that fit for an eating disorder? I think it does. I think it does for many, many individuals. Now, let me address one thing particularly to family members. Some of you may have a hard time understanding addiction. Why does she do that? If it's this disgusting, if it's this self-abusive, how did she get caught in it, and why didn't she just stop? Let me help you understand it a little bit more by identifying what I believe to be the heart of the addictive process. The heart of the addictive process can be described by using this term. And we referred to it yesterday, and I want to elaborate on it a little bit more today. Compulsivity. I haven't come up with a simpler word than that to describe what is necessary to understand to really get inside the world of an addict. Here's what compulsivity means. Compulsivity is any experience, relationship, or event initially engaged in voluntarily for the purpose of enveloping my awareness that then begins to control me. The residents know that One of the things I like are paragraph-long definitions because they make a real nice outline. See, this has got three steps to it that really help you understand the process of compulsivity. Any experience, relationship, or event, anything. We'll give you some examples as we elaborate a little more. Any experience, relationship, or event initially engaged in voluntarily, I choose to do it, for the purpose of enveloping my awareness, providing an envelope for my awareness so that I can stuff my awareness away into that envelope. Make sense? So I don't have to be aware of it anymore. I can just kind of put it in that envelope, and I'm no longer aware of whatever that is. That then begins to control me. Let's start with an eating disorder. See, there is in and of itself nothing wrong with missing a meal. There is in and of itself nothing wrong with eating more than you need at any given time. We do that on Thanksgiving and Christmas fairly routinely, don't we? See, in and of itself, that is not an experience or event or behavior that is dysfunctional by definition. But when we choose that behavior as a way of wrapping our awareness up so that we're no longer aware, or another way of saying it is that it distracts us from our pain, then it is going to become compulsive. There is nothing wrong with running 5 miles a day in and of itself. But when I run 5 miles a day to distract me from my emotional pain, then it will become compulsive. There is nothing wrong in and of itself with working long hours at the job. But when I do that to distract me from my emotional pain, then it becomes compulsive. There is nothing wrong in and of itself with sexual activity. But when I become sexually active as a way of distracting me or enveloping my awareness so that I don't have to deal with my emotional pain, then it can become compulsive. Now, what have we listed so far? Eating disorders, workaholism, compulsive exercise, sexual addiction. Couple more. There is nothing wrong in and of itself with having many intense relationships. But when I engage in relationships for the purpose of distracting me from my emotional pain, then I can become a relationship addict. I've got to always have something out here cooking to take me away from the pain inside that I don't know what to do with. There is nothing wrong in and of itself with being active in your church. But when you are so active in your church that it distracts you from your own emotional pain, then you are a religious addict. Are you following me? Now, can you think of a behavior or an event or an experience that could not be compulsive, that could not become compulsive? I haven't found one. Real frankly, I think about this a lot. I examine my own life in the routines that I enjoy. There's nothing wrong in and of itself with getting up before the kids do and having your morning cup of coffee with the paper while the house is still quiet. But if when you don't get that, you start flipping out, it sounds to me like you may have allowed that routine to become compulsive. That it's the way you stay away from your pain, whatever it may be. Now, what might that pain be? For instance, with that minor example there at the last, the pain may be that I have an intolerance for my children's energy level and level of need in the morning. And I need to grow in that area of my life. But I don't want to admit that. So I distract myself away from that by making sure I have my morning routine. So here's the litmus paper test. Do without your morning routine for a week. See how you do. One of the best reasons for being sexually abstinent is to learn to not let the act of sex control you. Because see, here's what happens. Whatever behavior you chose to distract you from your pain has such a payoff that it then begins to control you. Let's go back to the example of workaholism for a second. It's very attractive to be needed at work, to be indispensable. You know, you come back from vacation and everybody goes, "Oh, Dr. Don, we missed you so much. We couldn't hardly do without you. Listen, we've got two or three things that we didn't know what to do because you weren't there." It really makes you feel good, doesn't it? Does it really make you feel so good to know that they can't do without you? How's that going to affect your vacation next year? "Gee, Dr. Don, I don't know if we can do it again. Maybe you better just work 52 weeks a year." All of us are in jobs that never get done. Even if you work on a factory assembly line, there's always more parts coming down. If you're in the helping services professions, your job never ends. There's always more that can be done. And it is one of the easiest things to slip into, to become needed and necessary and indispensable. It's a counterfeit, though. It's a way of distracting you from the awareness that what you really need is to be wanted, not needed. In relationships, doesn't it make romantic songs for him to sing, "I want you, baby. I need you, baby. I can't live without you, baby"? Do you really want a man who can't live without you? It gets kind of scary, doesn't it? See, it sounds a little bit colder, but it's a lot healthier to be involved with a man who says, it would cut deep if I lost you, but I would get over it. I really want to be with you. See, that sounds a lot colder, doesn't it? But it's a lot healthier. I want to be with you. I know that I could live without you if I had to, but I choose you. Now see, I can get that pretty romantic if I work at it. But it's a different way of thinking. It's a different way of thinking. Don't let yourself fall into compulsive patterns. That's what happened to the eating disordered individual in your life. She didn't want to deal with something, and she just found something else to engage herself in instead of whatever it was she didn't want to deal with. And it trapped her. It got her. Now, this is not so easy to get out of. Once you recognize it, why don't you just stop? I asked that same question about St. Paul, who wrote the book of Romans in the New Testament. You know, this guy wrote 2/3 of the New Testament, I think. We're talking major Jesus figure here, you know? I mean, everything going for him. And it's him that in Romans chapter 7 wrote these words, "I do not know what is wrong with me. With my mind, I agree with what I ought to do. But I find a different law at work in my body. So I end up doing that which I do not want to do. And I don't do what I do want to do." Now, does that sound like you? See, this is not an easy prison to get free of. And that's exactly what it is, a prison. This is the heart of an addiction. And I believe it's the heart of an eating disorder. It's why we continue to behave in ways that hurt us, because we don't know how to deal with whatever that other issue is that is also hurting us. Now, I'm going to move on. I've got a couple more points I want to cover with you about the heart of an eating disorder, what an eating disorder really is about. An eating disorder is oftentimes an attempted solution. An attempted solution. Now, it's obviously not a real successful solution, is it? Or you wouldn't be here. But let me show you some of the other problems that it may be an attempt to solve. It may be an attempted solution to the problem or the task of individuation. I have to throw in a little psychobabble every once in a while so you know I know it. When kids are about two, we call them the terrible twos because they start learning to say no. and they can say it in more tones of voice and in greater variety of expression than you thought imaginable. It becomes their word. Now, here's what us church people do. We interpret that as rebellion. That's that rebellious spirit coming out, and I'm not going to let it happen. And so we do everything we can to stamp it out. Big mistake. Because for most children, that is not rebellion at 2 years old. That is what we call differentiation. It's the beginning of the child being able to be aware that somehow she has a separate life from her mom and her dad. That I'm not just an extra arm or appendage on my parent. I have a life of my own. I don't necessarily agree or feel or think with everything they agree with or feel or think. For some parents, that's real threatening. For the mom whose world is so empty that her child is her only relationship, she may not be able to tolerate that much separateness of opinion. For the mom who is so depressed and hurting with her own pain, she can't stand the idea that her child would begin to have a life of her own that might even be healthier in one way or another. Now, most of us as parents want only the best for our children. But oftentimes what we do is we get threatened by this process of moving away from me, and we want to hold them close. If the child's differentiation is blocked, then this next step of individuation won't develop. Like this. Until I can learn to say, no, I'm not, I can't move on to learn to say, yes, I am. Let me tell you about a church I went to. I joined this church about 10 years after it had been born. It was born by breaking away from its mother church because it disagreed with that church about some of its religious stands. And so when I joined the church, they were still in that stage of growth where they were defining what they weren't. No, we're not going to believe this, and no, we're not going to teach that, and no, we're not going to act this way. And there's some merit to that. Like that two-year-old, I think that's how churches and other organizations kind of emerge a lot of times. No, we're not going to do it this way. What's the next part? We are going to do it this way. 3 years later, when I left that church, they were still saying, no, we're not this, and no, we're not that, and no, we're not this. And 2 years after I had left that church, it died. It's no longer a church. Because it never learned to say who it was, what it was. Now, some of our residents are like that too. They walk through that front door and they're saying no to everything. No, I'm not going to eat this, and no, I'm not going to do that, and no, I'm not this, and no, I'm not feeling that, and you can't make me cry. And I just on and on and on. Now, some of that's real necessary because some of you never did that when you were little. Some of you were so good. And what I mean is, some of you were so responsive to your parents' needs that you never said no. Now, it doesn't just happen at 2 years old either, does it? The second cycle is the terrible 13s. I don't know why we don't call them the terrible. No, I don't believe what you believe about God. No, I don't want to wear my hair like you tell me. And no, I don't want to wear those clothes. And on and on. And again, we say, oh, yes, you will. As long as you're under my roof, you will too believe in God and go to my church and da-da-da-da-da. It's like, whoa. Now, here's what I'm encouraging, parents. I am not encouraging that you let your 13-year-old run the house. Ugh, can you imagine? Yeah, you probably can't imagine. What I am encouraging is that you decide which mountains are important enough for you to die on. My kids, every once in a while, talk about wanting rat tails. You know what I'm talking about? That string of hair down the middle right there. So far, it hasn't become a mountain to die on for them, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do if or when it gets there. I hate rat tails. I love long hair. When I was, my hair was shoulder length when I got out of college. I like long hair. I just don't like rat tails. Now, real frankly, I don't think that will be a mountain that I'm willing to die on. I think I would rather give my kids some space to be able to say, no, I don't think I want to wear my hair like that. I think I want to do this with my hair. Now, the day they come home and say, you know, Dad, I really don't agree with you. I think marijuana's okay. I'm probably going to say, this is a mountain to die on. Experimenting with drug use in my house is a mountain to die on. I'll tell you also, being sexually active before marriage is a mountain to die on in my family. I don't want my kids to do that. And I will work every way I can with them to help them develop the ability to wait for that gratification in life. I won't kick them out of the house if they're sexually active before they get married. It's not that much of a mountain to die on. I will not support them financially if they're into drugs. They'll have to support that habit on their own. There are mountains to die on, parents. I'm telling you that. I agree with that completely. Pick them carefully. Because every time your kid says no, it may not be rebellion. It may be this thing called differentiation and individuation. James Dobson says adolescence is kind of like a tunnel. You hope you point them right when they go into it, and you wait till they come out on the other end of it. You know, it's like, well, I'm not sure. What I'm encouraging you to do as parents and as prospective parents is do it well with your children when they're young. And then the no's that you hear during adolescence will be much more frequently this healthy process of differentiation and individuation and much less rebellion. Now, in eating disordered families, a lot of times no has not been tolerated. Well, eating disorders are a very subtle way of saying no. See, the anorexic is obviously saying, no, you can't make me eat. We had one of our residents describe her control battles when she was little about food. She would sit at the table for 3 hours just to prove the point. No, you can't make me eat. You can just almost see her stick her little lower lip out, can't you? She's trying to say, no. I can't always be controlled by you or think like you or feel like you or believe like you. I need a life of my own. Now, I think she picked a real sad thing to dig her heels in about because it will kill her if she's a successful anorexic. Have you thought about that? You know, the successful anorexic is the dead anorexic. Okay. So what I encourage you residents to do is if you need to say no, find something to say no about that won't hurt you. That won't hurt your growth and development. That will help it. That will benefit you. That will support you in that. Family members, when your children, be they young or adult children, need to say no to you, accept it in the spirit of individuation. The bulimic is saying, sure, I'll say yes on the outside. But you don't know what I do behind bathroom doors. See, it's a way of saying, in a secret way, I'm in charge, you're not. No, I won't cooperate. I won't do what you're saying. So, if we don't want it to continue to go on covertly, let's find a way to encourage it to go on overtly, out in the open, where we can deal with it in an acceptable way. Whoa, I hear you saying you want to make up your own mind about some things. Is that right? All right, let's talk about it. What do you want to make up your mind about? I tell you what I discovered when I do that with my parents. They are much more willing to let me make up my mind about things than I think they are a lot of times. I'm real afraid of them sometimes. I'm afraid, oh, what if they won't think I'm making the right decision or they don't agree with me? Well, they may not, but most of the time that's okay. They just kind of roll with it. But it's real hard to admit to face that as a child. Now, another problem that an eating disorder is an attempted solution for is the problem of privacy. We talk a lot about boundaries here in treatment. What that means is having a clear understanding of where I end and another person begins. Where my feelings end and another one's begin, which feelings are mine? One of the things that happens oftentimes in group therapy is somebody in the group will be overflowing with pain and everybody in the group will be hurting. It's like, wait a second, whose hurt is this? It's hers. Let her hurt. You don't have to absorb it. And it takes a while, residents, to develop those kinds of boundaries, doesn't it? Because we're used oftentimes to not having clear emotional boundaries or physical boundaries. Gee, It never occurred to me that I had the right to tell him, no, don't touch me there. Routinely occurs, doesn't it? It never occurred to me that I had the right to say, this is my body, I inhabit my body, I need to take care of my body. Spiritually, oh, I just thought I was supposed to believe that because they always said so. I doubt that. Spiritually, emotionally, physically, those are the three that I want to emphasize right now. Now, here's what happens in families that don't encourage the development of separateness, of boundaries, of having my own opinions or beliefs or thoughts or feelings. The result is I start to lose an awareness of my identity, of who I am. Privacy is necessary for me to develop a sense of separateness. Now, in some families, separateness is extremely threatening because what it threatens is belongingness. You see, some families define belongingness as sameness. The way we can tell that we belong is that we're all the same. What happens if sameness is stressed too much, then differentness does not occur, is not given permission and encouragement, and a sense of individuality or individuation then is impaired. So privacy is what allows for that development of separateness, so that we all start to have a sense that we are individuals. Now, belongingness is an absolutely essential human need. Everybody has to have a sense of belongingness. In my family, we've all got the same last name, Durham. I'm talking about my family of origin. In the family I grew up in, it's worse than that. I'm the oldest of five. Our names are Don, Dave, Doug, Dennis, and Delana. See, we can tell we belong because we all start with D. But I am not Dave, and I am not Doug, and I am not Dennis, and I am not Delana. I'm Don. So that there is a blending then of belongingness grounded in sameness, that we are alike enough to belong, but blended then with differentness, that we are not all the same. We are individuals. Critical. Now, when families are threatened by that, wait a second, in our family, we don't vote that way, we vote this way. No, in our family, we go to this church, we don't go to that church. In our family, we don't wear clothes like that. In our family, we don't do our hair like that. See, the list of sameness gets real long in lots of families. And what will happen is the developing woman will find a way to get her privacy in a sneaky way. You know what the counterfeit for privacy is? Secrecy. Secrecy is the counterfeit for privacy. When I don't have the right to privacy, I will develop a secret because it kind of feels like my own special place. Now, I've only had one family that took it to such an extreme that the interior doors on the house were all removed. The message was, we're all family, why do we need doors? Okay? Now, that's pretty extreme. That's pretty extreme. And I guarantee you, in a family like that, there will be a lot of secrets because it's the way I will try to feel like I have any privacy whatsoever. Here's the critical difference. There is always a sense of shame attached to secrecy. Privacy does not have associated shame. That's the difference. So let's talk about the secret world of your eating disorder. When you tell somebody about the symptoms of your eating disorder, does it feel like you're giving away a secret? It's like you're letting somebody into your secret world. Is there a sense of shame about your eating disorder? Yes. Then it's a secret, see, not privacy. But if you hadn't had any privacy, then you may settle for secrecy. It'll eat your gut out, though. It will eat your gut out because of the associated shame. Now, how do kids learn to use the counterfeit of secrecy when they don't have privacy? How do they learn that, moms and dads? We teach them, don't we? How often do we think we can fool the kids? You know, we'll be having an argument, and then we'll paste our faces back on and walk out of the bedroom door and act like the kids don't know what was going on. Dream on. You can even do it real quietly, and they know by the vibes in the room, don't they? My youngest, coming home from church just the other day, said, "Boy, I hope Mom's in a better mood when we get home. The house won't be a happy place if she's not." See, she doesn't even have to say anything directly. I can come home absolutely overwhelmed by work, and they know it. Even if I do all the right things and say all the right things, they know your feelings. So the wrong thing to do is keep it secret. The right thing to do is say, "Yeah, Mom and I are really having a conflict right now, but what we're fighting about is not your business, and we're not going to get a divorce." You see, that makes it privacy, not secrecy. I can't wait for the day when the kids ask what's going on in our bedroom on Sunday afternoons when we're taking a nap. I hope I have the common sense to say something like, "Kids, your mom and I are still in love, and we love being together, and what we're doing in there is none of your business." I hope that I have that presence to be able to have privacy without secrecy. I hope you do too. Now, I know that there are secrets in your family, and your children have learned the pattern of secrecy by watching you. 80% of what we learn as human beings is taught by watching, by observing. You know the old thing, "Do as I say, not as I do"? Not a chance. They're going to do as you do. So, one of those logs on the fire that you can take off are the secrets that you have held. They may not have anything directly to do with the eating disorder, but they set the pattern of secrecy. And as you own up to those, you will again set the pattern for the child in your family to own up to her secrets. And as that secrecy can be dispelled, then the shame is dispelled as well. What is done in secret must come to the light to be healed.